Thank you very much. Thank you very much, Dr. Marcuse. And now we'll entertain questions from the audience. Judging from the size of the house, it obviously will not be possible to acknowledge everyone who has a question, but if you'll raise your hand, I'll try and go around in some sort of order and at least pick some people from each section of the house. Let's start up here. Are there any questions? Yes, sir. Would you, Dr. Marcuse, elaborate on repressive tolerance in society based on democratic principles?
Yes, I'm glad the question is the first question, because no text of mine probably has given rise to so many misinterpretations. It is usually said that I wrote, it depends on the kind of newspaper you are reading. The most extreme formulation is that I advocated suppression of any opinions other than mine. I have read that. That is not an invention. Another interpretation is that come out for repression of all opinions which are against socialism. This is based on the, at the present level, of intellectual honesty, not surprising confusion between social legislation and socialism. So there's at least one thing in the text. What I did write, and I stick to it, is I suggested, in order to redress a balance between right and left, the withdrawal of toleration from all demonstrably aggressive and destructive movements, such as the Ku Klux Klan, the White Citizen Councils. I also mentioned the Nazi movement. And I said if toleration would have been withdrawn from the Hitler movement in the early 20s, we probably, almost certainly, would have spared the Second World War and the 40, 60 million of dead in this war. That is what I said, and by redressing the balance between the right and the left, and I would like to state that here as clearly as I possibly can, I still believe that politically the democratic process is a pseudo-democratic process. The public information today is practically monopolized by the mass media, especially television. Now, you know perfectly well that large funds are required to get adequate time on television, whereas the so-called silent majority, which is not at all a silent majority, but one of the most vociferous majorities in history, they get not only their information, also their spokesmen have access and wide access to all mass media, whereas the left simply does not have the funds to buy equal time. I don't have to tell you that there is actually no great oppositional newspaper in this country, still very much different from countries like France and Italy, and there is no real opposition party. So it seems to me that indeed the balance is very much weighted in favor of the conservatives and to the disadvantage of the left.
Thank you. Anyone else up in this area? Up here. Yes, ma'am. That's two questions. Will you just try the first one? Would you repeat that, please? Could you elaborate on the distinction between criminal gains and authentic communion?
Who?
All right, one at a time, however. I'll get back to you. One at a time.
Authentic communion. Criminal gains.
Yes, what did you want?
The second question.
Okay.
We'll give you that chance.
Yes.
Well, I hope that there's still a difference between crime and political activity. To me, at least, there is. And not every criminal act is a political activity in the direction of political progress on the left. I know the situation of the communes relatively well, and I would like to say from the beginning that I consider, still consider, the communes, well, testing ground, soil, for the development of new human relationships, non-conformist, authentically non-conformist human relationships. I also know communes in which what I said at the end of my talk tonight, the immediate identification between personal liberation and political liberation is prevalent, and who believe that as long as they can translate into reality their private needs and desires, they thereby have helped society on the road of liberation. Unfortunately, it seems to me this is not true. There are authentic communes to me, are only those communes who in the first place live together on the ground of real affinity in human relationships. Secondly, communes who work, an essential requirement. Communities who work either do directly political work, for example, print and edit so-called underground newspapers, journals, etc., or organize to go into the factories, sell newspapers in front of factories, and organize work living together, or who try to become the nuclei of counter-institutions. By counter-institutions, I mean, for example, such simple things. Obviously, a free society is unthinkable without a high level of technical progress. Obviously, a free society needs such things as computers in order to find out at the fastest possible way the priorities, the actual priorities, places of poverty, one other ones, and so on. In other words, the radicals must learn how to serve computers. They must learn how to organize work, how to organize production. Otherwise, we will have indeed a situation, and to tell you frankly, I don't think it is an entirely unrealistic situation, that indeed the existing system in a diffuse way disintegrates, but there's nobody there who can take the place of those who either have disappeared or don't want to do the job anymore and so on. So that, I would say, is one way of sketching very briefly and in a vague way what I meant by the difference between crime gangs and authentic communes.
Let's try the second question now. There's some response for it. When does urban terrorism fit into a potential revolutionary stage?
Urban what do you mean? You mean the bombings? Why don't you say so? Well, I think, I don't know, I have a confession to roses tonight here, I don't know why. I am usually not accused of being too non-violent and too soft. But according to my evaluation, the present bombings don't exactly help the revolution, but they may very well delay the coming of the revolution.
Yes, sir.
You have a opinion on negative income tax.
Your opinion on the negative income tax, Dr. Marcuse?
No, I tell you the truth, I don't.
Yes. I can't hear you. I understand that. Do you believe that any improvement in the present economy would be, in effect, a real improvement, or are there elements built into the system which this would negate?
Well, I must again refer to the fact that I think there is such a thing as a dialectical theory. There is not the slightest doubt that improvements within the present system are possible. There's also, in my view, no doubt that such improvement should be supported, even by the radicals. I think that the notion we should actually see to it that the poor get ever poorer, that the unemployed are no longer or again employed, because if they get employed and if they get less poor, they will become conservative. I think that this is a childish notion. So I do believe there are improvements within the existing system possible, but I also believe that in this society even the good things will carry their bad sides and their bad consequences. I do not believe that this society without fundamental change will ever succeed in abolishing poverty, in abolishing exploitation the world over. Because we cannot remain satisfied by improvements within our own society, within the borders of the national economy. The third world today has become part of the so-called living space of capitalism, and if the improvements in our own national society are bought at the expense, as they are to a great extent today, of continued poverty, oppression, and exploitation in the third world, that is one of the typical cases that even the good side in the society carries in it the bad consequences and the bad foundations.
Yes, the young lady right in the center. Young man, I beg your pardon. I do beg your pardon. He's sitting low behind the balcony rail. I can only see the head and his long hair. I thought it was a lady. Forgive me. Now the question, please. Okay. Thank you.
I haven't read the report.
Wait, may I repeat for the radio audience? The New York Times apparently quoted you as...
Time Magazine, I think.
Oh, it was Time Magazine. Apparently quoted you as saying that Spiro Agnew knows nothing, not having read your book. Is this an accurate quote?
You should expect the truth. It is not an adequate quotation. I certainly didn't say he knows nothing. He hasn't read my books. Which would mean that he can know something only when and after he has read my book. I did express doubt that he read my book, and even stronger doubt that he understood.
Anyone in this area of the balcony? Yes, sir. Would you repeat that again, please? Do you believe there's any country in the world that reflects an adequate social system?
Well, you see, the question requires a terribly responsible answer. Because it was, of course, very easy to say that today none of the existing societies, in the conditions in which it actually exists, could possibly be called a translation into reality of the radical socialist ideas. I think that is an unfair answer, because there is no country in the world the condition of which and the development of which is not in one way or the other determined by what is happening with the two superpowers. I am of the opinion that only a change in the imperialist metropoles themselves can indeed bring about a corresponding change in the third world and in Cuba. We know perfectly well that the situation in Cuba today is not exactly what we expected it to be. We know perfectly well the reason for it. We know to what extent the Cuban economy today depends on the Soviet Union, and we know that the Soviet Union is not exactly offering technical help and economic help without political strings attached. So that we cannot answer with respect to Cuba. The Chinese Revolution, I and you too suffer from the brute fact that we are not informed what is going on in China. There's not a single American correspondent in China, and the little news I get from French newspapers who have correspondents in China. One thing I would like to say, according to what I can see, the Cultural Revolution in China had the definite goal of avoiding the authoritarian bureaucratic development of socialism as we have seen it in the Soviet Union. There's a second thing, I think, which is pretty clear. The Chinese Revolution, up to this very day, is the only one, again, I suspend Cuba, is the only one in which the Cultural Revolution is also a cultural revolution in the narrower sense. That is to say, it is the only revolution that has explicitly and emphatically rejected to take the American way of life and the American productivity and the American consumer society as model for socialist development. The sinister slogan of the Stalinist period, that socialism means catching up with and overtaking the productivity level of the most advanced industrial country, is strictly rejected in China. And instead, what we may call in a very vague way, human values, the value of human dignity, of justice, fairness, are becoming part of revolutionary theory and revolutionary ideology. I don't see any reason why we should a priori say they will never be translated into reality there anyway. The last thing we can say with relative certainty, again I refer to the report, I read among them a report of a man who has just spent half a year in China. According to this report, I quote literally, nobody goes hungry in China. Now if that is correct, it would indeed be one of the greatest achievements of the 20th century.
Fifth gentleman.
Did you look back to the particular movement, in particular, what do you think would be the role of the vanguard for the leadership or the white black radical movement called the Lula? I ask this in particular, it's directed towards two forces that seem to be happening simultaneously. One is the progressive integration of a lot of leadership and the mass
Is it possible to reduce this question to a few words?
If you'll
repeat it and then answer it.
Well, I perfectly well understood the last question, what I think of the strategy of the movement for the last 5 years. That I can answer very quickly. If I would know for the last, for the next 5 years, what strategy the left ought to have, I don't think this is a forum to discuss. As to the other parts of your question, please correct me if I don't formulate them the way you did. You asked, if I understood you correctly, about the present splits and division among the movement. Is that correct? Let me ask it in terms of the question of the party. Now, I have, as you may remember, said before that I don't believe that in the present situation a radical mass party can be formed. There are several reasons for it. I don't want to go into it here. In the first place, the suppressive apparatus is much too strong and much too effective, and the leadership of such a party could be put out of circulation within 24 hours, and then the party would probably disintegrate. On the other hand, I personally cannot see how radical change, the dimension of the second half of the 20th century, how such change can possibly be accomplished without organization. And the consequence we have to draw from it is that some new forms of organization, probably far more concentrated on local and regional issues and conditions, will have to be found. As to the role of the Black Panthers and the relationship between the black and the white movement, I still believe that any kind of patronizing leadership on the part of the whites over the black movement would be fatal, quite apart from the fact that it would be rejected. I think the blacks and the browns are by now perfectly capable of forming their own organizations and even of defending themselves, which of course does not exclude, but on the contrary would necessitate, very definite alliances between white, black and brown radicals with respect to certain issues. The division among the left may be a very large one and a very deep one, but I do not see any reason why, for example, PL and workers, Students Workers Alliance, communists, whatever it is, why they can't get together with respect to a very single specific issue and organize their opposition in this issue together. This kind of temporary united front is certainly something that seems to me should be done and could be done.
Yes, young lady up there. If we were to withdraw our toleration from the fascists, how do you decide which groups, what priority, who makes the decisions?
Well, you see, today, those who make the decision as far as I can see, are anyway far removed from democratic popular control. The decision to a great extent is made by the Justice Department, by Mr. or Mrs. Mitchell, and others, so I don't quite understand your sensitivity to the undemocratic or anti-democratic way of deciding who is aggressive or who is not aggressive. What I said in the repressive tolerance essay is that in a democratic society, of course, the individuals themselves, the people themselves, would know and would decide and would be able to see which movements are indeed destructive and which are not.
All right, let's go downstairs now. Any questions from this area? Yes, sir. I didn't get the second portion of it having to do with the peace. I didn't get the second portion of the question having to do with the Nixon peace plan, was it? The so-called peace plan, all right. Well, what's the question? Of the peace plan being a hoax as accepted by the liberals, or is it? I think, have you got it, Dr. Marcuse?
I got it, but I think the two questions, the question is still two questions which are rather separable from each other, and I want to. I mean, whether or not you say it's an obvious hoax, the trouble is that in politics today, it is very hard to distinguish what is a hoax and what may have some effect. You see, it may well have been submitted as a clever political maneuver for certain purposes, and there are, in spite of everything, forces at work which are even beyond the control of Nixon and his administration, and what turned out to be a hoax may be something different. I don't say it is, but we should not simply be satisfied by saying it is an obvious hoax. Now, as to the first part of your question, the balance, if I understood you correctly, the balance of counter-revolutionary and radical forces, is that what you meant? Well, again, if I should give you my evaluation right now, I would say the balance is very definitely in favor of the counter-revolution and not in favor of the radicals. That explains to a great extent the state and conditions of the movement today. I think it would be fatal to see this kind of division and this kind of isolation as the defeat of the movement. I believe that the movement is at the beginning and not at the end. And if we start to become that easily defeatist, all we do is play into the hands of the establishment. Again, I must say, and I think that is for any would-be revolutionary an excellent criterion and standard, the ruling class always knows these things far better and has a far better instinct than the radicals themselves. You can bet your life if the administration, the federal as well as the state administrations, see their only enemy in the radical student movement and in the black-brown radical movement, they know why.
Yes, sir. Tell them on the stage. Do you believe that
the large Hispanic population,
yes.
The large Hispanic population itself could be a contributing factor to a repressive.
Do you believe that the expansion of the population itself could be a contributing factor to a repressive movement in this country?
Well, the role of the population growth today is, you are quite right, a political factor of the greatest importance. In the first place, the system depends on an ever-increasing number of customers. That is the most obvious fact. To the degree to which we really have a runaway productivity of labor, we need more and more goods to be purchased on the market and more customers to purchase. And one of the most interesting developments today is you see that the mass media, even the reactionary ones, appeal more and more to the young and younger generations. For example, there's a remarkable change in the makeup of Life magazine and Time magazine. And I talked with one of the editors about it, why this sudden rather liberal compared with previous attitudes, a liberal stance in Life magazine and Time magazine, and he said quite clearly, we have to rely more and more on younger readers. Apparently the older ones are not capable of reading anymore at all, or they don't want to read anymore. So this again is a very important factor. Thirdly and lastly, and again, this is dangerous to say, I believe that a voluntary reduction of the birth rate will indeed turn out to be one of the pre-requirements for building a decent society.
Yes, sir.
Well,
that is very... Wait, the role of political assassination and social change in revolution.
That is relatively easy to answer because we have historical evidence and we don't have to go on speculation. Correct me if I'm wrong. I know of no case in which individual terror or small group terror has brought about any change. It seems to be that terror is effective only if the group which practices terror is already in power. The classical example is the Jacobin terror under Robespierre. There you have the ruling group which is exercising the terror. You have the Hitler terror after 1933. But individual assassinations have in history at least in the modern period, as far as I can see, in no way affected a radical change. You see, persons become increasingly exchangeable and fungible. If you kill one politician, the other one is already waiting to take over. So this is no good.
Let's try the gentleman in the rear. Please. Yes.
Given a society in which the counter-revolutionary forces are very strong. And given within that society there are contradictions which are ever more becoming apparent, both to those on the radical revolutionary stance and those who are of the counter-revolutionary stance, how is it possible for any real transformation to come about without changes or without tactics that will not be branded as criminal?
Spoken right into the microphone, so give it a right ahead. For the benefit of you, Dr. Marcuse, and the uninitiated, the reason for my repeating the questions when I am able to do so is so that in case some of you in the hall cannot hear it, it is picked up in one microphone, and for the radio audience, which could not possibly pick up the questions at a distance, it is picked up in the second microphone when I repeat it. But in this case, when the speaker spoke into both of them, it's not at all necessary.
Now, sir, would you like the question repeated?
Yes.
Would you like to repeat it? I'll give you the opportunity.
In a society, how is it possible for meaningful change to come about in this system without repression, without the forces who would change in a radical direction using methods that will be branded by those who maintain the system in power as criminal action?
If I can translate the question, please correct me if you don't like the translation. Can you imagine a non-violent revolution? Is that the gist? Well, again, I'm in the happy position to refer to the evidence of history. So far, we didn't have a non-violent revolution, and I can get one step further by referring to Marx, who said that a revolution is always as violent as is the violence with which the ruling class fights the revolution. In other words, revolutionary violence, historically speaking, is counter-violence. That was the opinion of Marx. Whether in the 20th century, in the second half of the 20th century, you can accept and expect a non-violent revolution is a different question. I don't know how many of you have read the long article in the New Yorker by Charles Reich, or Reich, who has read it? Has anyone read it? It is one of the most interesting, since I just read it, maybe I may say a few words about it. You know that his thesis is that the coming revolution, and according to him, we are already in the middle of it, will be a non-violent revolution altogether. Now, if a critical essay appears in the New Yorker, you can be damn sure about three things. First, that it is beautifully written. Secondly, that it comes very close to the truth. And thirdly, that after having read it, you are perfectly satisfied and happy, and you are in no way disturbed in your expectations and in your conscience. This article succeeds in, and I want to see that to say that quite frankly, first in giving an excellent analysis of what he calls the corporate state. Of course, a monopoly capitalism isn't good enough. What he calls the corporate state, and an excellent analysis of the radical movement today. But perhaps by the miracle of the beautiful style, he succeeds in transfiguring the radical movement into a Sunday school exercise and into a Boy Scout movement. That is exactly the impression with which I was left after reading this article. Nobody can possibly have any objection against it. If he lists as commands, one of the 10 commands or 4 commands of the movement, be true to yourself or love your fellow man or whatever it is, we have all heard that before. Nobody has ever objected to it, but of whether the translation of these commandments into reality really can proceed the way he believes, namely that more and more people will become conscious of what is going on today and will simply no longer accept these values and no longer work for them. Again, there is very much to it. I too believe that a change, a radical change in the consciousness and in the instincts of people must precede radical change. But how it can ever be imagined that this is the end of it, that is beyond my imagination. There would still be, you cannot simply count, that those in power would simply sit by and watch the whole thing pleasantly going on. There would still be required some kind of organization. There will still be counterforces. And the idyllic picture of the radical movement, I'm afraid, just isn't very realistic.
The center of the hall here. According to the question you see as being part of our political and economical plight, is it possible, in your view, that this might be part of man's nature rather than the system?
You mean that human nature is, by nature, essentially unchangeable, for example, as far as innate aggressiveness is concerned? Is that what you mean?
If it's human nature, how can it be changed?
Well, that's a different part of the question. I will try to answer it. You asked, is there any guarantee that, assuming there is a revolution, assuming it was successful, that the old nonsense, the old repression, the old domination will start all over again in new forms? Well, there is no insurance. There is, however, one thing, and in that I see the almost unique historical importance of the radical movement today. Namely, if those who finally bring about the radical change already represent a different type of human being with different values and with different instincts and aspirations. You are quite right. If you take human beings who were brought up in a repressive society, their parents were already brought up in it, you cannot, it would be a miracle, if once the new institutions are established, you also have the entirely different values and you finally can translate the possibilities of human freedom into reality. I cannot share this optimistic view, which extremely formulated means that the new human being, the free men and women, will be the byproduct of socialist institutions. I don't believe that. I believe that in order to create genuinely socialist institutions, you already have to have the new men and women with the new instinct and the new values. And in that I see the tremendous importance of the cultural revolution in the West here today. Now, as to the immutability of human nature, as you may know, of course, I base my opinion on Freud, who certainly wasn't an optimist in these things. All I need in order to explain my opinion is that you agree that human instincts in their expression can be modeled and can be modified. In Freud's terms, primary aggressiveness can very well be put into the service of the life instincts, into the service of the erotic instincts, and aggressiveness thus sublimated can feed the use of technology and technique in the reconstruction of the environment, an aesthetic, peaceful, beautiful environment. You would still have aggressiveness here, because naturally matter would have to be transformed, changed, destroyed, given new forms and so on. But it is definitely placed into the service of the betterment of human life and therefore loses its destructive implications.
Any questions from the center of the hall? Yes, sir. A little louder, please. I'm going to ask you to repeat that because I didn't follow you. I lost a few words and then lost the whole thought. Would you mind? A little louder, though. If an organization is necessary in a revolutionary movement, your opinion is solicited on the kind of an organization and the success
of it. Well, I don't want to talk about the possible forms of organization at the present juncture. That would be mere speculation. I would, however, like to remind you that there are historical models in the history of radical movements, for example, a leadership or even a division of responsibility and authority based on the continual responsibility of the elected leaders to those who elected them, to their local constituencies, either in factories or villages or on farms or wherever it may be. You would here have the combination of leadership and at the same time a new democratic control.
Now from this side, yes, sir. The question, Dr. Marcuse, what are you doing to prevent acts of terrorism?
Well, I mean, after all, we have an FBI, and after all, we have a police, and I don't think it is my job, and I don't think I would be very good at it.
Any other questions? Yes, sir. Do you see the possibility of an elitist outcome of any revolution being inimical to the goals of this revolution?
Well, I think the question is very close to the question asked here, and my answer would be very close to it too. There are possibilities, although by now, until now, they have rarely been translated into reality at all, of preventing such a development by, you may call it democratic centralism, whatever it is, in any case, by a leadership which remains responsible, recallable at any moment, if it has no longer the confidence of the local or regional, regional constituents. That would be a non-elitist leadership.
How about from here? Have you a question? I'll get to you in a while. Would you talk right
on? I'd like to know if you see the possibility for women being liberated during the revolution that you're talking about, or do we have to wait for a couple of other revolutions to happen?
It's been said into the microphone.
I don't know. May I repeat your question whether women have to wait for their liberation until the revolution?
No, will this revolution provide them a liberation, or must they wait for additional revolutions before they acquire it?
I must say, without giving my opinion on the women's liberation movement, that I cannot think of any socialist platform which does not include the liberation of women. That seems to me self-understood. And actually, it would not be necessary to have a separate liberation movement for women. For example, the demand for equal pay, for equal job, the opening of all jobs to women is part and parcel of the oldest socialist platforms. And certainly I cannot imagine any revolution which does not achieve these goals. So I don't know whether there's anything else you want me to add or what. It is part of one and the same revolution. We cannot have side by side a whole host of revolutions.
That may well be, Dr. Marcuse, that that answer may get you in more trouble than any other answer you've given tonight. Now, there was a question up here.
Women's liberation movement anyway, and there's one thing, as I said, I support the movement very much. There are certain things in it which I do not support. I feel in the women's liberation movement, I told you before, I have a confession to Roses tonight, I feel in the women's liberation movement some very strange resurrection of Puritan concepts, some kind of allergy against sexuality and against sexual objects or being sexual objects or whatever it is, which sounds a little strange to me. But I may well have been misunderstood the whole thing.
Are you the gentleman? All right.
In view of the daily terrorist activity of the United States Police, the daily terrorist activity of the United States Terrorist Force, is there some way in which you think you could look at a violent act without considering its sole characteristics to be defined exclusively in terms of the physical force of the enemy?
Can you consider, in view of alleged police brutality or Air Force violence, any particular act that can be divorced from...
Well, I think I have answered that question already, and I think the answer is relatively, you may regret it, but it's relatively simple. You haven't got the physical force. So that's not your choice at all.
Question here.
Philosophical premises underlie capitalism as you see it concerning the nature of men, which inevitably or in some way, as you want to put it, cause a necessary relationship between the implementation of capitalism in a society and what you call exploitation, crime, terrorism, drug addiction, etc.
Well, I'm sorry, that is one of the few questions I think I just cannot answer because it would really require, in a short space, an analysis of capitalism, not only at the early stage, but at the present imperialist stage. I only want to answer one question, but it seems to me is in the one part, which seems to me is in the context we have discussed tonight. It seems to me it is a requirement inherent in capitalism, that is to say requirement for its continued working and growth, that human beings are and have to earn a living. That is to say that the life of human beings is considered as a means to an end which in many cases comes too late or doesn't come at all. In other words, the idea of labor, alienated labor, as absolutely essential because of alleged or real scarcity or technical immaturity or whatever it is, as absolutely essential in the struggle for existence. And it seems to me that this basic, if you want to, moral requirement of capitalism is today wearing thin and has less and less justification. And as I try to outline, I see in that really one of the most dangerous tendencies of disintegration.
We have time for two more questions. Let's have them for people who haven't asked them yet. All right, we'll start then.
Ideological basis, which dates back some
Do you see any possibility of a relationship of the church in any revolution that might be
undertaken? Facts. It is a fact that some of the most sacrificing, some of the most uncompromising, some of the most heroic, in authentic sense heroic, members of the liberation movements in Latin America were and are Catholic priests. And you know perfectly well that even here in the United States, some Catholic priests are in the forefront of radical movements. That certainly doesn't mean the institutionalized church, but it certainly does mean that the tradition of the church, ever since the great heretic movements of the Middle Ages, still has this radical potential.
All right, the gentleman right in the center. Yes. This will be the last question. Would you explain your reference to the psychological discontent of people today being manifest when they work?
Well, it will take me some time. I will try as briefly as I possibly can. This, you see, is again a decisive change which goes far beyond the psychological impact. You said psychological changes. Namely, the idea of responsibility, the idea of competitive efficiency, the idea of the absolute necessity to perform a job well, is disappearing, not only among the upper and middle classes, but even among labor. If you read the reports from the factories, especially I think of some of the automobile factories in Detroit, the attempts in one way or the other to slow down work in such a way that it cannot be caught and punished, even such acts as putting nails into the motor of an automobile or loosening screws or whatever it is, may be characteristic. I read another story from Detroit, which is in my view representative among a minority. Again, I will say for the time being it is a minority. One of the steel plants hired a young worker to replace an older welder in the factory, and the foreman showed the young laborer how the job is being done, and the young laborer talked with the old one he was supposed to replace and asked him, now say, that stuff you are doing here, don't you get any scars? And the man opened his shirt and showed that his whole chest was scarred. Whereupon the young laborer, who was supposed to take the job, only said, no thank you, and he walked away. Now, this kind of attitude is, of course, maybe isolated. I don't think it is isolated. And I don't think that more and more people get the terrible and crazy idea that maybe they can live and continue to live and perhaps even live better if they don't work that much and in the way in which they work today. This is a dangerous idea, but it may be spreading.
Thank you very much. One moment, please. Dr. Marcuse, if you were asked, in view of all that's been said this evening by the audience and by yourself, if there were one thought that you might like to communicate to this audience to take home and remember, what would that thought be?
Well, the thought, I can only express one thought. I wish you would remain young, and I wish you would remain as you are.
The meeting is adjourned.